All right, so we're going to move on to session number two, where Lewis says most of my books are evangelistic. But before we do that, I want to say something that I didn't get to in our last session, if I can. This issue of the love of God. So I'm on an airplane every week. I taught class Wednesday morning, jumped on an airplane, flew out to Newport Beach, California to speak at the gathering of the Christian Legal Society, their opening event. Got on a red-eye special so I could go back to Wheaton, Illinois to teach class yesterday morning. Right after class, got on a plane and came out here for this. And that is a little more unusual than my regular schedule, but not far off. And I love it. I love my life. I like sometimes taking students with me when I do this stuff. And it's great. But the result of this is I'm in limousines going from the college to make it to the plane right after a class. And I'm amazed how many of the limousine drivers in the company my secretary books are Muslims. And I just have a great time talking with Muslims. And I think God loves Muslims. I pray for the Islamic world. I've actually met four Muslims who came to Jesus because God showed up in dreams to them. One, I was in Senegal, Dakar, Senegal, and this guy was a pastor of a church. I asked him how he came to faith, and he said, well, I used to be an imam, and God showed up in a dream and talked to me, and I became a Christian. Now I'm pastoring a church. It's very interesting. Well, this one guy, I get in the car, and he says, I see I'm driving you to Wheaton College. It's from the airport to the college I had to go to. I see I'm driving you to Wheaton College. What do you do there? And I said, I'm a professor. He said, what do you teach? And I said, well, my degree is in philosophy of religion, my doctorate. And he said, oh, what religion are you? I said, I'm a Christian. What about you? He says, I'm a Muslim. And then he says to me, what's the difference between Islam and Christianity? And I said, well, you know, I hate to confess to you, I've only read about half of the Quran. So when it comes to matters of the Quran, I'm going to defer to you. But I have read the Bible many times, and I am aware of it, and I am aware of some differences in the sections of the Quran that I've read. I said, for example, well, first off, I said, you got to get objections out of the way. First off, I said, many Muslims I've met think that Christians believe that God came down and cohabited with a woman, and that's where Jesus came from. I said, no Christian believes that. None. He goes, really? Because you see, if they think we believe wacko stuff, then they're not going to take much credit in what we say we believe about other stuff. So take the goofy stuff off the table. I've talked with other Muslims and say, oh, I don't believe that Christians believe that at all. So not all Muslims are the same, just like not all Christians are the same. We shouldn't be surprised. But I said that to him, and he said, wow, I didn't realize that. I thought Christians believe this. And I said, in Surah 3, I think it is, it says that Muslims don't believe in the Christian God because Muslims don't believe in a God of Trinity. And the Christians believe in a God of Trinity. And I said, that's the biggest difference to start with. And I said, number one, I'm going to ask you three questions, and you help me. Do you believe God is a contingent being or a non-contingent being? I've had this discussion with at least 200 Muslims over the years, and it's always gone the same. They freak out when we get to the end of the inquiry. Do you believe God's a contingent being or a non-contingent being? Usually they ask, what does contingent mean? And I say, do you believe God is necessary, eternal, self-existent, or do you believe that God has causation? Does God need anything outside of himself? Oh, no, I believe he's non-contingent then. I say, okay, second question. Do you believe God's a God of love? Now, you might expect the Muslim would say, I believe he's just, or I believe he's good, or I believe he's merciful. But 100% of the time, the Muslims I've talked with have said, no, I believe he's a God of love. So then you ask, who's the object of God's love? And they're reduced to saying creation or the people that he's made. And I say, if God needs us to fulfill his nature, then God is a contingent being and not a non-contingent being. And you have an inherent contradiction in your theology. Because relational attributes in a non-contingent being presuppose that relationship must be necessary in that being. And once they get it, they freak out. It's a moment of disequilibrium for them. Disequilibrium always precedes any kind of change, whether it's a change of kind or a change of degree. My present conceptual framework is not sufficient enough for me to deal with this data. I've got to change. Hafiz said to me, I'm tracking with you. He said it no less than 18 times in this discussion. Oh, his name, did I tell you his name? Hafiz Muhammad. Okay, so he says, I'm tracking with you. I said, okay, another difference has to do with something else. C.S. Lewis in Mere Christianity said, if you're a Christian, you don't have to believe everything about the other religions is necessarily false. But if you are a Christian, you have to believe that those places where Christianity differs, Christianity is true and they are false. And by the way, all Christians have much more in common with any person who has any kind of spirituality than we do with the materialist. Okay? So work with the things you have in common. So I said to Hafiz, there was a German philosopher of religion, his name was Rudolf Otto, and he wrote a book called The Idea of the Holy, and he distinguishes three things in common with all the great world religions. If you want a brief summary of his book, read the introductory chapter to C.S. Lewis's The Problem of Pain. He gives a distillation there. The first thing that Otto observed about the great world religions is they all believe in some divine essence. They will describe it differently if they're an animist, a pantheist, a polytheist, a monotheist, a monotheistic Trinitarian, a dualist, whatever. Second, all the great world religions, and by the way, he said when I said that, I'm tracking with you. Second, all the great world religions believe in a moral code that people fail to keep. And I said, as a consequence of that, third, they all believe that the divine essence is a custodian of the moral code, so if I failed to keep the moral code, I've offended the divine essence. He said, I'm tracking with you. He said, I believe in the afterlife, and I don't want to go to hell. I'm doing everything I can to not have to go to hell. And I said, do you believe God's a perfect being? And he said, yes. I said, so how are your works doing? He says, I'm afraid. I live in fear. I said, here's the thing that makes Christianity different than all the other religions. The reason why this doctrine of Trinity is so important is because we believe God's a God of love. And his love is not conditional. He loves us. And there's nothing we can do that will merit his love. It's nonsense. And we get to receive the love that he's given. And even though we are people who have failed, we are what the Bible says, sinners. This God, his love is expressed in forgiveness, and he forgives. And I said, I don't know a person who's lived a moment of honest life who fails to long to be loved unconditionally. And I don't know a person who's lived a moment of honest life who fails to see that they're messed up. And I don't know a person who has lived a moment of honest life that wouldn't like resources to help them fix what's broken inside. And I said, we believe God has done that for us in Christ, who loves us, who forgives us, and who will enter our life. And he said, I'm tracking with you. That's the most comforting thing I have ever heard in my life. I said, Hafiz, is there any reason why you wouldn't want to trust Christ right now? And he said, none. And he prayed out loud with me in the car to trust Christ. And so I've been able to do some follow-up stuff with him. It's all been kind of fun. But it just came with where we left off last time, this idea of the love of God. That's where the gospel begins, to remind people of the things they've long neglected and long forgotten, that we could be loved and forgiven. So I was talking with a guy not long ago. This was a guy, my best friend, was an All-American football player, captain of the football team at Wake Forest University years ago. So every year we go together to a Wake Forest football game somewhere. We try to go to historic stadiums like Notre Dame or West Point or something like this. But we've been back for games at Wake Forest several times. And my best friend's college roommate was a guy, Frank is his name, and Frank was recruited to go to Wake. He was the number one high school recruited athlete his senior year of high school. Was recruited by Arnold Palmer, a Wake Forest alum, who calls him up and says, Frank, I want you to go with, this is Arnold Palmer. I'm a golfer. Oh, really? Yeah. And I want to take you with me to see Wake Forest. Okay, Frank says. He's a high school kid. You can imagine. When do you want to go? I'm going to fly up in my jet tomorrow to pick you up. And he takes him to Wake Forest and spends the weekend with him. Where do you go if you're Frank? You go to Wake Forest. Frank won the Brian Piccolo Award for the number one football player on their team that year. This was a guy who could cut through defensive lines like a hot knife through butter. 4 years ago, Frank had a heart attack. While he was in the hospital with a heart attack, he also had a stroke. And here's Frank, who walks like this now. He's the mayor of his town in Pennsylvania. Dear guy, good guy, heart, big heart for people, caring guy. We'd walk into a room. I'm an extrovert. My best friend Tim makes me look like an introvert. He's just so magnanimous and outgoing and stuff. I would walk in a room with Frank and Tim. They all love to see Frank, and they all love to see Tim, and they all admired Frank. And he walks in like this. So the three of us stayed in a hotel room together for that weekend. And I was always the last one to shower because those guys were bigger than me. Always when I'd go into shower, there was a towel stretched out the whole length of the tub. Because Frank, this brilliant running back, has to have a towel down there because he's afraid he might slip in the tub. So for breakfast, the day before we go, Sunday morning, I go down and I said, Frank, you know, I've showered every time after you, and there's a towel on the floor of the tub. I said, you have that there so you don't slip, don't you? And he says, yeah. I said, how hard is that for you? This great, great athlete who now has to put a towel down. He said, it's hard. It's really hard. I said, you have hope? So the doctors say he might get some function back over time, but it'll never be where it should be at his age. I said, do you think about death much, Frank? I try not to, he says. It scares me to death. So we start talking about that. We got to the place where we were able to talk about the love of God, and we were able to talk about forgiveness. We were able to talk about all these things. And he says to me, if it's like that, Jerry, then how come I can't receive that love and forgiveness and then just go out and do anything I want to? He says, that doesn't make sense to me. I got to do something to gain it. I said, you know, Frank, I don't think it works like that. I said, my dad was a Marine in World War II. He was in three D-Day invasions. He was in the first wave at Tarawa, the bloodiest battle of World War I for real estate gain and life loss. First wave. 5,000 Marines went in on the first assault, 30,000 in all to take an island the size of the parking lot of the Pentagon. The beach he went in on, 1,500 Marines went in. That's the one where they misjudged the tides and let them off at the reef and a bunch of guys drowned. Took them 4 hours to get to shore. And when they got to shore, there were 200 surviving Marines. And my dad was one of the eight that was sent up to take the flamethrower, to take out the bunker that had wiped out so many of his mates. The other seven were killed, and he was the one that took out the bunker with the flamethrower. He's hearing these people scream. I said, Dad, what were you thinking when that occurred? He said, my thought was the mothers of those boys won't be getting letters from those boys. What sensitivity in the cacophony of battle that he would think that. Second wave at Saipan, first wave at Tinian, the island taken for the landing strip to do the atomic bomb. My wife's father was the last surviving pilot to fly on the two atomic bomb missions. He died last summer. But my dad was the Marine who went in to take that island, horribly wounded, Incredibly strong guy, though. Old Marine. I knew he loved me. I'm one of the great. I have one of the great experiences of life. I don't have one bad memory of my father. No memories of conflict with him. No memories of feeling unloved by him. It's a great gift. But I never heard him say it. I'm telling Frank this story. Never heard him say it, that he loved me. When I was a sophomore in college, he came up to me and just, very uncharacteristic of him, he put his arm around me and he said to me, "Jerry, I love you." I said to Frank, "How do you think I responded? You think I spit in his face? You think I walked away and said, 'It's about time you told me. How come you didn't tell me till now?'" He said, "No, you probably got misty-eyed and told him you loved him too." I said, "Exactly. I don't think that you're going to say, if you really understand this, and I could go out and screw God. I think you're going to say, 'I'm overwhelmed. I want to do the best I can to follow him, not because I have to earn his love.'" And I told Frank, I found myself, when my dad said he loved me like that, coming home on weekends from college to help him rake the leaves, mow the lawn, and wash the car. And I thought to myself, you know, I could be coming home to rake the leaves, mow the lawn, and wash the car to try and get him to love me. Or knowing he loved me, I could come home, rake the leaves, mow the lawn, and wash the car. But there's an eternal difference in motivation. And if I understand what love means from God, it's going to transform the way I think about my relationship with him and so on. So this just gets back to this whole idea that we were talking about on the love of God. There's reality. Reality is iconoclastic. I can always think more. God's big. Let's worship him. But then Lewis gets down to these ideas of love. He said the thing about pride, but Lewis, one other thing I didn't tell you. Almost the last thing he writes with his pen, a little girl from America, her name was Ruth, wrote to him. She liked his books. And he wrote to her. She was 11 years old. He didn't have to write her back. If he wouldn't have written her back, no big deal, right? But he's on his deathbed. And he writes this girl back, and he says to her, "If you continue to love Jesus, nothing much will go wrong with you. And I pray you may always do so." And I think that's it. That's where we're going to go with Lewis. Okay? Now, next area right here, we're talking about, Lewis said, most of my books are evangelistic. What did he mean by that? Well, let's pray as we begin this session. Father, I pray for each of our sessions. I know that what I offer are just crumbs, not much more than that. Human understanding about various themes that fascinate us, but it's just one man's take on it. It's crumbs. But Andrew offered your son 5 loaves and 2 fish by the side of the Sea of Galilee for the feeding of 5,000. It also was crumbs, next to nothing. But your son took the crumbs and did something with it. I pray your Holy Spirit would take what's offered now and would do something with it so that each person here, each person coming here with different presses on their life, different circumstances surrounding them, that each person in their unique set of circumstances would be able to hear something from what I say because your Holy Spirit was opening their heart and making the segue and connection, and that each person would leave here getting what he or she needs to get, because they would see the connections to their circumstances. For that to happen, we need a miracle to take place. We pray, Lord, that you would have your way with us and that your Holy Spirit would do this work among us. Testimony to your love for each of us individually. And we ask this in Christ's name. Amen. When Lewis said, most of my books are evangelistic, what did he mean by that? Well, certainly there are some that are explicitly so. You look at his apologetics works. Problem of Pain was the first apologetic work he did. There was also Mere Christianity, which he did over the BBC during World War II. By the way, Winston Churchill, at the end of World War II, was voted out of office. Shortly after that, he was voted back in for a second term as prime minister. In his second term as prime minister, he championed for C.S. Lewis to be knighted. And Lewis refused to take a knighthood, because he said, I don't want... Lewis leaned towards Churchill's political party and some of his political views. But Lewis said, I do not want my ministry to be so connected with a political party that it would crest or fall with that political party. I want to be able to minister Christ to people. So he didn't take the knighthood. He's one of the few people in the history of England who didn't take a knighthood. It was offered it. But you have Mere Christianity that he broadcast over World War II. It got to the place where he was the second most heard non-BBC broadcaster after Churchill during those days. I've talked with people who lived in England at that time, heard the broadcast. He said people were tuning in all over. And then there was Miracles, which is probably his best apologetic book. It's a little more complex and theoretical, but nevertheless, it's very good. Some might say The Abolition of Man also, and that's a book that Mortimer Adler included in the Great Books of the Western World in 1968, putting it up there with books like Augustine's Confessions, Thomas Aquinas' Summa Theologica, and so on. Very good book. But so there's some books that he writes that are explicitly evangelistic. He also wrote to Sister Penelope, something we'll talk about in our next session, a friend of his, that his Out of the Silent Planet, which was the first of his science fiction books, it came out just before Problem of Pain, he said, I've learned that any amount of theology can now be smuggled into people's minds under the guise of romance, telling a story. Okay, so Lewis was also recognizing the implicit sharing of the gospel could be done in story. So this takes in then a lot of his books, Great Divorce, Screwtape Letters, Narnian books, the science fiction stuff, and so on. But even his literary criticism, I would suggest to you, is evangelistic in the sense that his faith-integrated understanding of literary criticism is manifest in those books. So he's looking from a Christian worldview at other subjects. Lewis actually said, we don't need more Christians writing more books about Christianity. We need more books by people written on other subjects with their Christianity latent. G.K. Chesterton said, he became a Christian for two reasons, apart from the gospel itself, which was so compelling. Two things drove him to Christ. Number one, he looked at what the detractors of Christianity said about it. And he said they said such opposite things. You've got Marx who says religion is an opiate. It drugs people. Why did he say it was an opiate? Well, if you read Marx and Engels, you know, the whole thing with Marx is he's taken Hegelian philosophy, thesis, antithesis, resolves itself in synthesis. Synthesis becomes a new problem. Synthesis becomes a new thesis. Looks for antithesis, and it resolves itself in synthesis. And Hegel said, if it's moving, if it's progressing, there must be something causing the progression. And Hegel, who was kind of a pantheist, said there's some spirit guiding the process. A little bit amorphic as to what. Because you'd say, if Hegel's right, then the synthesis of the moment, which is going to lead to higher syntheses, if he's right in making that judgment, then he's only right temporarily, right? Because that's going to be resolved into some higher synthesis. But Marx, if you read the Communist Manifesto, says, no, we're not going to have any more antithesis to communism because we're going to eliminate all the opposition. We're going to destroy them. See anything in campuses going on today? You have something different than what we think? We don't want to engage you. We'll destroy you. It's interesting to me. There's a lot of Marxism behind some of the stuff that's going on in communism. Read the Communist Manifesto. It's very short. You can read it in an hour. It's very interesting. But anyway, so Chesterton saw that Marx said it was an opiate. By the way, if you read Marx and Engels, you know what the opiate is? Forgiveness. Because all history, he begins the manifesto with, is class struggle. And if you have people forgiving, you eliminate class struggle. And if you eliminate class struggle, we don't have a revolution. So forgiveness is a drug. Causes people to be willing to love people. We can't have that. And then Chesterton saw that Marx was saying this, but then he saw Freud was saying, no, it creates neurotics. Christianity creates neurosis. And Chesterton said, it's an opiate and it creates neurotics? How's that work? Those are equally opposite. And then he got other people who said, Christianity is a religion only for women. Another said, Christianity is a religion where women don't have a place. He goes, how's that possible? And other people said, Christianity is too violent. Onward, Christian soldiers. And others said, Christianity produces pacifists. He says, how's that possible? He said, this must be the most remarkable thing out there that its detractors keep getting opposite understandings of it. He says, I got to investigate this thing for myself. That was one. Second thing that got him looking was this. He said, I didn't believe in Christianity because one or two things proved it. I believed in Christianity because virtually everything seemed to suggest its truth. He saw it as the great integrator. And so on. Okay, so Lewis is like that. Most of my books are evangelistic, not because they're about Christianity explicitly, some certainly are, but because they have a Christianity embedded in them, a worldview embedded in them. People love Tolkien. I was asked to come debate a pagan, this woman who claimed to be a pagan. And I was supposed to debate her on is Tolkien, is the Lord of the Rings pagan or Christian? And this group asked me to come debate. I said, are you kidding? You really want me to debate this woman? I'm not a big debater. I said, but I'll show up for that one. So the woman makes her case about how the Lord of the Rings are pagan. I said, well, let me read you a piece from Tolkien. I am a Christian, so naturally what I write is written from that perspective. I said, is there any more to debate? No, he's a Christian. And he wrote from that. Tolkien himself led Lewis to Christ. Lewis says in Surprised by Joy, J.R.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson were the human causes of his faith. And Lewis was intrigued by myth and so on. We'll talk about that in our last session. But he has this understanding that a faith-integrated life is very, very helpful for the proclamation of the gospel. So I want to play out some specific things in Lewis's writings that will be helpful in this regard as we share our faith. But let me begin with a transition that I'll create if I can. When you talk to somebody who doesn't know Christ, I think you can ask public questions fairly. What's your name? Public question. If you meet them and they're from Portland, you say, are you from Portland? Listen to the answer. I met a man once in Chicago and I said, what's your name? He said, Peter. I said, Peter, are you from Chicago? He said, no, I grew up in Albuquerque, but when my parents divorced, I moved to Chicago with my mother. He didn't have to tell me his parents were divorced. He gave me that information. He also gave me permission to ask about that. If he would have just said, he grew up in Albuquerque and he moved to Chicago when he was 12. I would have had enough to go on by that alone. Do you remember when you were 12 years old? What was your life like when you were 12 years old? You're on the threshold of adolescence, that most purgatorial period of human development. And he's moving away from his childhood friends to go through that period of life with no support. I could have just asked him about that. That would have been enough to go on. And listen to the answer. Every answer gives you permission to ask about that question or that issue. But he said his parents were divorced. So I said, tell me about that. And he talked about it. And in the conversation that ensued, he basically said that he was bitter towards a father who had abandoned them and never remembered his birthday or Christmas or anything. And it wasn't even that experience was so bad. It was that he didn't like what the bitterness that was developing in him was doing to him. And he wanted to know how he could be set free from the bitterness. I know how to connect now the gospel to his deep felt need in a relevant way. Not just presenting the gospel like shooting a shotgun out in the woods. I want to hit the target. I don't believe we take Jesus to anybody. He's already there. He's more interested in that person than you and I will ever be. Where is he already tugging at the heart? Where is he already at work? And I get to go make explicit what he might be doing implicitly. It's kind of cool. And you get to be an ambassador of good news. 2 Corinthians 5, where it says at the end, we've been given the word of reconciliation. We're ambassadors of Christ. And that we've been given the message of reconciliation, that God was in Christ reconciling the world to himself. But I want to connect the message to the place where God's already tugging at the heart. Okay? So anyway, I'll give you another example of this idea of engaging in the conversation, not going deeper than the person will allow, but making the most as we listen to what's going on with that person. I was coming back from Bratislava, Slovakia. It's a few years ago. And I was coming back from spring break, coming back to Wheaton College. For spring break that year, I went to Bratislava to give lectures on C.S. Lewis. And the people that had me there dropped me off at Vienna Airport, which is only about 45 minutes from Bratislava. And I get checked in, and I get to the gate area, and I find out the plane's delayed for 3 hours. I love the anonymity of airports. I break out my books, and I start reading. It's not long before this young woman comes walking into the gate area. She has a lanyard, a name tag, she has a clipboard, and I see her in German walking up to people, asking them questions in German, and writing on the clipboard, and then going to the next person and doing this, and I figure she's taking a survey for the airport. Eventually, she's going to get to me. Sure enough, I'm reading, and she comes up, and she speaks to me in flawless English. I'm thinking, what am I wearing that she'd speak to me in English rather than German, right? One day I said that to somebody, and this guy said, "Didn't you say you were reading?" I said, "Yeah, well, what language were you reading in?" "Well, I was reading in English." "Well, she was probably brighter than you were at that moment." So she said to me, she was doing a survey for the airport. Public question, "What's your name?" "Allegra," she said. I said, "Allegra, are you from Vienna, the city where we're in?" "No, I grew up in southern Austria." "Oh, what brought you to Vienna?" I'm just going with the information she gives me. "What brought you to Vienna?" "I'm a student. Where can I go from that? Where do you go to school? What are you studying?" So on. So we have a conversation about that. I said, "Do you have any other relatives still in southern Austria?" "Only my father, but he's a bitter man." "Oh, what's he bitter about?" "My mother left him to go with her lover to Canada. And she had every good reason to leave. He's such a toxic person." "Tell me about that." "Do you have other family?" "Yeah, I have a brother." "Where is he?" "He's also at the university, but we don't get along very well either." I'm starting to get a picture here. She said, "But it's way worse than that." I said, "Allegra, how's it worse?" She said, "I had a boyfriend, and he went to study art in Florence. And he told me to wait for him, and I've waited dutifully for him the 6 months while he was gone. He got back yesterday to tell me that he met somebody better in Florence. So I guess the rules didn't apply to him, you see." And this is a woman who feels abandoned, isolated, alone, unloved. I know where the gospel could connect with her felt need. 20 minutes have passed. She hasn't asked me a question. I know her life story. Not by intruding, only talking about the things that clearly she wanted to talk about because she put them on the table. So I said, "Allegra, I know you've got to do your survey, but I've been sent here to tell you something." Then she thought I was a plant at the airport to see if she was doing her job right. And I said, "No, it's nothing to do with that. But I have been sent to tell you something just as each of you have been sent." Ed Stetzer, who's the head of the Billy Graham Center at Wheaton College, says, "Christ's last command should be our chief concern." So she goes through her questions real quick. How long did it take you to get through, to get checked in? How long did it take you to get through passport control? All this stuff. You expect she's done. She looks at me and she says, "What were you supposed to tell me?" I said, "Allegra, the God of the universe knows you. He knows you and he loves you. Allegra, he loves you. Allegra, he would not abandon you. He loves you." Sometimes you have to say it 3 times for it to soak in. She bursts into loud sobs. Everybody in that gate area is looking at me as if I'm torturing this poor girl. And she said, "But I've done so many bad things with my life." Remember when Isaiah came into the presence of God, a holy God, and he sees his sin? She came and heard about a loving God, and she felt free to unpackage the fact that there were things that she regretted in her life. And I was able to say to her, oh, Allegra, Jesus knows about everyone. And that's why he died on the cross, to forgive you of all of that. It wasn't hard. Okay, so we can get there, but the point is, in those asking of questions, you want to get to the deep felt needs. And Lewis writes about this, and other authors too. I want to read you a passage. This is from Evelyn Underhill. She's another author I got to through Lewis. If I would have gotten to her before I got to Lewis, I'm convinced I would have made Evelyn Underhill my life's author. Evelyn Underhill was the first woman given university-wide lecture status at Oxford University. She was a philosopher of religion, eminent person, eminent academic. She was also the first woman made a fellow at University of London. She wrote 33 books. She also, like Lewis, wrote some fiction, wrote some poetry, but her philosophy is breathtaking. In her early days, she was very theocentric, but not Christocentric. In her later days, she came into the influence of Baron von Hugel. Remember, beware of the first clarity, press on the second clarity. Von Hugel was her spiritual director, and she embraces Christ. And everything she writes after her encounter with von Hugel around 1923 is decidedly Christocentric. She's almost an exact contemporary of G.K. Chesterton. Born in the 1870s, dies early in World War II. I'll tell you about her later, because she wrote to Lewis a couple times. They had some correspondence. But also Charles Williams, who was one of the Inklings with Lewis and Tolkien and the others, he was the one who edited her letters, and the letters she wrote to Lewis are included in that. Lewis didn't save his letters, but he saved hers. Matter of fact, just quickly, when she wrote to him, he wrote her back and said, "Receiving a letter from you is the greatest literary experience of my life." Have any of you ever read any A.W. Tozer? Okay, she's A.W. Tozer on steroids, this woman. Okay, so she wrote this about the longings, the deep longings, and it's the deep longings I want to get to when I'm talking to a person. She wrote this about the deep longings. There's three deep cravings of the self, three great expressions of man's restlessness, which only mystic truth can satisfy. The first is a craving which makes him a pilgrim and a wanderer. It is a longing to go out from his normal world in search of a lost home or a better country. The next is that craving of the heart for heart, of the soul for its the search of the soul for its perfect mate, which makes him a lover. The third is a craving for inward purity and perfection, which makes him an ascetic, and in the last resort, a saint. So she talks about the pilgrim longing, the lover longing, and the ascetic saint longing. Okay, those three. Lewis, in the first book he writes after he's a Christian, and by the way, his first book that he writes after he's a Christian, his first apologetic book, is a work of fiction. It's the only allegory he writes. It's called The Pilgrim's Regress. And the subtitle is An Allegorical Apology for Christianity, Reason, and Romanticism. And in this book, there's a pilgrim. His name's John. He has a vision of an island, and that vision sets him on a quest searching for the object of his longing. And in his searches, he finally comes to history, a hermit who represents history. And he asks history about the deep longings of the heart. And history says, well, there's three great expressions of the longings of people's heart. Listen, if there's three, it's not an exhaustive list. There could be 3,003. But he talks about three in this book. And he situates them according to particular ages where we see literary expressions of these things. The first one he talks about is the longing that's awakened by myth. The Greek word mythos, myth, simply means story. Longing awakened by story. And he situates it to the classical era, the time of Homer and Virgil and so on. The second kind of longing, he says, is the longing for the lady. And he situates this in the Middle Ages and particularizes it in the writing of Dante and Chaucer. And then he talks about the longing for nature. And in this one, he situates it in the writing of the Romantic poets, particularly the English Romantic poets. But you could think of Goethe in Germany, Schiller and so on, but you can think in England of Keats, Shelley, Byron, Coleridge, and Wordsworth particularly. Okay? So there you go. I want to suggest to you that Underhill's Longing of Pilgrim, Lover, and Ascetic Saint, and Lewis's Longing of Myth, the Lady, and Nature are synonymous longings. And I want to talk about them, because if I can get the discussion around to these things, I am completely in the belief that people long to talk about spiritual things. Augustine was right. Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in thee. We are spiritual beings. And in our culture, people are starving for this kinds of conversations. We just have to get into the conversations in a non-intrusive and non-abrasive way. People are not even looking towards Christianity. Why are they not looking towards Christianity? Because the culture has portrayed the church and the people in the church as a bunch of doofuses. You watch any television show, almost, there are exceptions. Watch almost any television show where you've got a priest or a pastor or a person who's a Christian, and they're always a jerk. And if a person doesn't have exposure to the church, they're believing the myths that are being passed on. I can't tell you the number of times my students will say, yeah, I got to talking with this guy who's a pretty secular guy, and he says, you're the most interesting Christian I've ever talked with. My students will say, well, how many Christians do you talk with? And they say, none. Why is this so interesting? Because they have a view of Christianity that's been, in some senses, media-driven, and it's false. There are some jerks among Christians. Don't be surprised about that. There's jerks among every class. Thomas Aquinas said, an abuse does not nullify a proper use. If you judge any segment of society by their worst examples, none of us could stand. We all know this. And not only that, we look at our own lives, and there are times we've been jerks ourselves. We just have to make it right. Learn from our stupidity and confess it. Go ask forgiveness of the people we might have offended and get back up, dust ourselves off, and get back into the game. So anyway, let's look at them. So Lewis talks first about myth, story. And he situates it in classical times. And it relates to the pilgrim longing that Underhill's talking about, because Lewis is looking at things like Homer's Odyssey. What do we know about Ulysses in the Odyssey? He just wanted to go home to Penelope after the Trojan Wars. He just wanted to go home. When he gets home, what do we find out in that book? It's not the same. The suitors are there trying to take over his wife and so on. And he has to do battle to set things right. Has any of you read The Hobbit? Or The Lord of the Rings? In both of those situations, Tolkien does the same thing with us. He has a hobbit, you know, who's on a journey. And you've got, you know, Bilbo Baggins. These 13 dwarves come. They want to reclaim their ancestral home that's been taken over by a dragon named Smaug. You can't go on a quest with 13. You got to have 14. So Gandalf, you know, hoodwinks him into going with the four. I've got 13 grandchildren. I'm waiting for the 14th to be born one day, and I'm going to nickname him Bilbo Baggins. If it's a boy or girl, it's going to be called Bilbo. But so he goes on this journey. If you read The Hobbit, 18 times in that book, he longs for home. He the first night he has to sleep on hard ground instead of his feathery bed at the Shire. He longs for home. When his provisions go stale, he longs for the fresh food in his larder. Back home, when they face danger with the trolls, Tom, William, and Bert. This is Tolkien. He writes characters with names like Gandalf, Gladriel, Elrond. But when he's got evil trolls, William, Tom, and Bert, you know, what does he do there? This is crazy. Anyway, he longs for the safety of the hobbit hole back at the Shire. 18 times he's longing to go home. And when he goes home, what do we find? Just like Ulysses when he gets back to Ithaca. It's not the same. The Sackville Bagginses have declared him dead. They're dividing up his stuff. He demands it back, and they say that he's just an imposter. And Tolkien has worked his magic. We long for home with Bilbo through the whole book. And then when we get home with Bilbo, we find it's not that home we're really longing for. The home longing. You go to Virgil's Aeneid. What do you do with the Aeneid? Well, you've got Virgil trying to give the Romans a mythology. We'll talk about it in our third session. But in this story, You've got Aeneas, who is a hero of the Trojans. And Ulysses now has snuck his way in with the Trojan horse and all that stuff. And Troy is being sacked. Aeneas's wife is killed. And the crown prince Hector and his wife's ghost both come to him and say, don't fight the Greeks. Hightail it out of here, take as many as you can and start a new city. And the whole story is Aeneas in quest of the new city, always longing for the city of his birth, Troy, which is no more, and the city that will one day be, which is Rome. Augustine was not a fan of the ancient myths. He loved that one because he thought that was true of all of us. We are people caught between the two cities, the city of our birth and the city that will one day be. And we see this longing that's in our hearts. And sometimes you have to talk about it, and you bring it up, and you maybe cite it, situate it in literature, and so on. I think, though, we have our own experiences of it. You know what it's like for me when I go back to my reunions? I go back to that place in L.A. where I grew up. I remember that elementary school playground. My word. I think Magellan couldn't have made his way across it, even though he was the first one to circumnavigate the earth. It was just forever, that playground. You'd be in the kickball court, and if you were going to kick the ball, only Brian Anderson could get it to where it would land near the handball courts. And basketball games, I mean, you needed a JATO rocket to get that ball up into the hoops because they were so high. Remember those elementary school basketball games? Recess after recess, the score is 4-6. Because it took forever. I go back and I think to myself, how did we ever have fun in this cramped little playground? I can spit and hit the handball courts. And the baskets, they come up to my eye. I can dunk it just standing flat-footed. And you go finally to the banquet, right? And they give you a name tag. And the name tag has your yearbook picture on it because nobody would recognize you otherwise. All my old friends, guess what? They're all bald. They have gray beards and thick glasses and kind of paunchy. I'm fine, but life's been hard on them. We go back, it's not the same. And we long for something constant, something that is the same. My oldest son, Jeremy, he's 39. When he was a boy, if there was a play at Wheaton College and they needed a kid, the then theater director, by the way, our present theater director, Mark Lewis, the Oregonian. Isn't that interesting? He's a great guy. He's one of my closest friends. But back then it was Jim Young, and he'd call up and he'd say, could Jeremy come down and try out for this part? And he was in several plays at Wheaton College in those days. One day he was playing young Pip in the adaptation of Charles Dickens' Great Expectations. First third of the play, he has the majority of the lines. He's living the life of a college kid as a 10-year-old. We can't find him at home. We go up to the dorm, and we find him in the dorm of his good friends with their earphones on, rocking out to their music in the dorm. He's living the life of a college kid as a 10-year-old. They used to do 14 performances in those days. I go to pick him up after his last performance. They gave him his hat from his costume. He was so pleased. We go walking through the theater, and all of a sudden he discovers that the tradition of the students is that they don't leave the theater the last night till they've dismantled the set. And he's looking at this shock that this world he's come to love is being destroyed. And he said, Dad, I got to sit down. He looked like Obi-Wan Kenobi when that planet blew up and he knew there was a disturbance in the Force. And he sits down. After about 15 minutes, I said, come on, Jeremy, we've got to go. And he walks out to the car like an old man. When he gets to the car, he stops and he says, Dad, I just didn't want it to end. I said, I get it, Jeremy. But it's the nature of every play, it has to come to an end. It's the nature of every holiday and vacation has to come to an end. It's the nature of every year in school, it's going to have to come to an end. As a matter of fact, it's the nature of your childhood. It will one day come to an end, Jeremy. Maybe what you're really longing for is the one thing that never has to end. And he looked at me and he said, do you mean heaven, Dad? And I said, yeah, heaven. Heaven. There's a longing for place that each of us have. It's built into us. It's in our genes. It's in our DNA. It's at the core of our being. And how many people have set out to try and tether that longing to something temporal? It's okay. We can enjoy temporal things for what they're worth, but as soon as we let them be substitutes for eternal things, we will be disappointed. Second longing, lover, lady. So when Lewis talks about the lady, he situates it in the Middle Ages, and he's talking with Dante in mind primarily. I remember when I first heard about Dante, Mr. Trejo's 7th grade world history class. I can still see the yellow textbook. I can still see the picture on the page of Dante at the Ponte Vecchio at the Arno River in Florence with his hand on his heart, and Beatrice is walking by. And we were told that Dante met this girl named Beatrice. And he lit a candle in his heart for her. And all of his life, even though he married somebody else, he was always carrying a candle for Beatrice. And I thought to myself, well, Dante's a chump. I didn't want anything to do with Dante. I heard that from Mr. Trejo, and I just was prejudiced towards Dante. I wouldn't even bother reading Dante. Then I get into Lewis. Lewis thought Dante was the greatest poet ever. Not only that, I get into Charles Williams, who wrote a book called The Figure of Beatrice. He loved Dante's poetry. Not only that, he talked to Dorothy Sayers. And Dorothy Sayers said, I have a schoolgirl knowledge of Dante. I need to go back and read him. She went back and read him, was so taken by it. She went and learned Italian so she could read it in the original. She was so taken by it then, she ended up translating the first translation of Dante. She didn't finish it. She didn't get to the Purgatory or the Paradiso, but the first two books she translated and maintained the same rhyme scheme that the Italian has. And I'm going, my heroes, Lewis, Williams, Sayers, and an off comment from a 7th grade world history teacher. I said, I better go back and look at Dante. And I started with the Vita Nuova, new life. In the 9th day of the 9th year of his 9th month, he saw Beatrice Portinari. And something was lit in him. But was it a candle for Beatrice? Or was there something more? He sees her 6 to 12 times in his life. What did she mean to him? He writes the Vita Nuova when he's about 25. It's when he's in his 50s that he writes the Divine Comedy. And when he writes the Divine Comedy, he begins to explain that he is in hell, finds himself in hell. Who's guiding him? Virgil. Virgil, who was, for Dante, the greatest poet. Virgil, the one who's writing about the longing for home. Virgil is guiding Dante. Guides him halfway, guides him through the inferno, guides him halfway through the purgatorio, and Beatrice comes out of heaven and collects him, and she's the one who ushers him on into the paradiso and ushers him to the very threshold of the divine beatific vision. And then Dante writes, she turned to look, but not at me. She turned to the eternal fountain. And what Dante was saying was, all human love, properly understood, as great as human love is ultimately telling us something about our nature that sets us questing for the ultimate love of our soul. Matter of fact, it's interesting, when C.S. Lewis's wife Joy dies and he writes The Grief Observed, the book he wrote after his wife died, he ends those words in Italian. He ends that book in Italian with the very same words, she turned to look, but not at me. She turned to the eternal fountain. Let's go back to the idea of lover in Underhill. Have you ever felt lonely before? What does that tell you about your nature? If you felt hungry, it tells you need food. If you felt thirsty, it tells you need drink. If you felt lonely, it tells you you're a sociological being. You're made for others. The fact that you can communicate tells you you're made for community. But have you ever felt lonely in a crowd? Have you ever felt lonely living under the same roof with other people you care for and you know they care for you too? That fact doesn't prove anything, but might it not strongly suggest you were made for some relationship no mere human relationship can satisfy? It sets us on quest. It sets us looking for the ultimate love of our life. Okay? Third, she talks about the ascetic saint longing. Lewis talks about the longing in nature. I think these are synonymous. When Lewis is talking about the longing in nature, he's basically referring to Wordsworth. So Wordsworth in the prelude is writing, as he ages, he's finding that he's becoming more calloused and more jaded. You know, they say age leads to wisdom. It might not. It could lead to stubbornness, could lead to being jaded and bitter. We've seen all kinds. But as Wordsworth aged, he saw he was getting more jaded. He didn't like it. His quest for nature was to try to go back to the lost innocence of his youth. He wanted what was broken in him fixed. When Underhill writes about it, the longing of the ascetic who wants to somehow break away from the world and sit and contemplate brokenness to the place where we move towards something that might look like sainthood. Do any of you like the writings of Frederick Buechner? Somebody say yes? So did you read Godric? It's a book he wrote. He was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. But it would be a thing like that. Godric is this saint. He lives about 100 years. The first 50 years of his life, he's just a scoundrel. And then he comes to faith, and this he can never forget the scoundrel that he was. Some of that's still there. Some of that DNA is still there. And he longs to do better. And this is what Underhill's writing about. This is what Lewis is writing about. I give you some examples. Because we often suppress this longing. We often start to believe things about ourselves that aren't true. I was speaking, we were talking earlier, I think, Duane, about Hartford College. Who'd you say went there? James Husson? Yeah. So Hartford, I've had the privilege of speaking at about 8 different Oxford University colleges. The way I got to Hartford was the guy who was a chaplain in those days was a guy named Michael Chantry. And he asked me to come preach in their chapel a few different times. And this one night I was preaching in chapel and he invited me to have high table with the faculty. I don't know if you've ever been to high table at Oxford, any of you? Have any of you ever been to a Harry Potter movie? Do you remember when they're sitting in the dining hall and the owls are flying in and out with them? That's a real place. That's the hall at Christ Church College, Oxford University, the dining hall. It's the most spectacular of all the dining halls. The dining hall at Hartford College is not quite that spectacular. But I would say it's probably this room, if you cut down this room size by about one third, it would be about the size of the hall at Hartford. The tables run the full length of the hall. That's where the students sit. Perpendicular to them and elevated about 3 steps is the high table where the faculty sit. If the students are eating roast beef, the faculty are eating prime rib. If the students are eating steak, the faculty are eating filet mignon. There are huge paintings of famous graduates and benefactors. John Donne, the poet, went there. William Tyndale, the Bible translator, went there. Huge paintings on the walls. And they're looking down at you, I think, to make sure you use the right knife, fork, and spoon. Everybody comes dressed in their academic gowns. The meal begins with a Latin prayer, and the wine pours freely. And it is a place where you could cut the pretense with a knife. It's so thick. And it's no problem if you don't take yourself too pretentiously, but it drugs people. Chantry introduces me, having just spoken at Evensong. Latin prayer, we sit down. There's a woman sitting across from me, and she teaches history there. And her first question, once we sit down, very loud, so everybody will be brought into the discussion. So, Jerry, why are you a Christian? I thought she was asking because she wanted to know. Other people told me no, they thought she was asking because she wanted to make me the entertainment at that night's dinner. Well, I could have entered into some philosophical or theological argument, and the thing could have drifted into even more pretense. But she asked, why am I a Christian? And I said to her, you know, I am aware of deep, deep brokenness in my life. I'm not aware of all of it, but I'm aware of enough of it to be devastated. And I don't think I could make it in life if I didn't know that God loved me. I also have high ideals. I believe in the high ideal of love. But I've had sharp words with people I say I love most in the world. And I don't like that incongruity in my life. And being aware of those things, I was overwhelmed when I heard that God loved me and forgave me. And I'm a Christian because I'm aware of that brokenness and I'm aware of that grace. And she was taken back by that answer. I don't think it was what she was expecting. She said, well, I could appreciate that, but that's just not my issue. I said, really? I think I understand what you're saying. I didn't become a Christian until I was in my first year of college, and I didn't become perfect overnight. That took 2 or 3 weeks to happen. And the whole faculty table busted up in laughter, gut-wrenching laughter, and it went on. And I said to her, your laughter just betrayed you as the laughter died down. She said, why is that? I said, because you and I just met, so you couldn't possibly know the specifics in my life that made that statement incongruous. But you laughed at the incongruity of my suggesting I had my act together. Either your read of history or your read of your own life shows you nobody's got it together. She said, you got me. I said, I'm not here to get anybody. I said, how do you get by knowing the incongruities in your own life? And she said, well, I have faith in humanity. I said, I'm interested in anything that's going to help me. Can I ask you about your faith in humanity? I said, have you ever been wounded by another human being before? She said, of course. I said, have you ever wounded another human being before? She said, I suppose so. She was a little softer on herself. I said, how does this faith in humanity work when we live in a world where we're broken and the people around us are broken? Just then the man sitting next to her who taught French there said, how does it work for Christians? And we spent the rest of that meal talking about the love of God, the grace of God, the forgiveness of God. People want to get better if they're honest. Sometimes we can be dishonest. And our dishonesty and self-deception can run deep in us. So every time I've had a discussion with people and they bring up the hypocrisy issue, you know, I don't want anything to do with Jesus. There's too many hypocrites in the church. Have you heard that one before? I say to them, I think it's perceptive of you that you've seen that. It breaks my heart, but I think it's true. And you know why I think it's true? They say, no, why? I say, because I'm one. I'm one. I believe in the high ideal of love, but I've had sharp words with people I say I love most. I believe in justice. There have been times as I thought back on it, I've been unfair to people. I didn't mean to be, but I realized I had been. C.S. Lewis said, you have to awaken in a person a sense of sin. Buechner says, before the gospel could be good news, it's got to be bad news. But Lewis says you don't get anywhere pointing out another person's sin. You get further by being open about your own struggles. And the fact that you can be seems to indicate that you're a little more secure. It must indicate there's something in the love of God. But when I've said to the person, you're right, I see it, I know, I'm one, I've seen these things in my life, you know how people respond to that? Well, when you put it like that, I see incongruities in my life too. And the door that seemed to close on the gospel now seems to open in the midst of that honesty. And so you say to the person now, because you're two pilgrims on the same road trying to figure out how to do this life thing as broken, fallen people, what have you found works for you? Often they say, I haven't found anything. And I can say, do you mind if I share with you what I'm starting to see makes all the difference in the world? And they say, yeah, because there's felt need now. And we talk about the gospel, and it gets Velcroed to the place of felt need. And it becomes like a lifeline to each of us who are drowning. And I'm amazed at the response. And so here's this Lewisian approach where all of my books are evangelistic. It's not that they're explicitly so, but they're talking about these longings. And they bring people to the place where they see their own story reflected in his story. Did I go too long now? Where are we at? Right an hour. Okay. One question? One question.